I'm Allison Jacobson, and I am alcoholic. I'm looking through your group announcements. My sobriety date is June 5th, 1993. I have a home group. It meets on Tuesday nights. It's simply called the Buckingham Group. A lot of you have been out there. It's a step discussion meeting. And I've got a sponsor, and I attempt to work with women. Sometimes that, well, I'll get into that later. And I want to thank Billy for asking me to come here today. I was thinking, I was actually talking to my sponsor right before the meeting started, and we were just talking about how blessed we are that we have each other, because if I didn't have AA and subsequently the people in my life directly because of AA, that would render me by myself. And I don't think I can get sober by myself, and I sure can't stay sober by myself. And sometimes we all get into this mode of, I've got this to do, I've got this to do, and this is very inconvenient, blah, blah, blah. You know, as many of you know, today was the opening day of the NFL. I can't let the day go by without saying that. And Redskins won, yay. And it was really funny because I just found out something new about my sponsor. She's a huge football fan too, and so that's kind of neat. And I had a beautiful time driving out here today. I met Lynn at her house early this afternoon, and I got to listen to it on the radio. I had the mountains as the scenery. It was great. And I couldn't imagine being anywhere else tonight, and I really, truly mean that. And quite frankly, I feel blessed that I'm even asked to be anywhere on most nights, because that sure didn't happen when I was drinking, and definitely it didn't happen my first few years of sobriety. If you asked me somewhere, you didn't ask me to come back. So thank you for having me tonight. And I've been to this meeting before, but not in a long, long time, so it's neat to be back here. I started drinking when I was 13. A lot of people I've met as of late have started drinking at a much earlier age. I heard somebody say they started drinking when they were 8, and I thought, oh my gosh. But my age is 13, and I used to live in upstate New York for the first 13 years of my life. So I will tell you, I had some consequences as a direct result of alcohol early on. And I had 4 Molson Goldens, a flask of Burgundy, and a flask of vodka. And I got taken home in an ambulance. I was sick all night. We had company. It was embarrassing. The whole neighborhood knew what was going on. And I woke up that morning, and I knew I would do it again. Even though I felt absolutely awful, I'm assuming I experienced my first hangover. I couldn't remember most of the night, so I experienced a huge blackout. But I was introduced to the effect by alcohol, and it was wonderful. Our book says men and women drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol, and my husband and I always joke with each other, and we say if we were going to ever change a word, it would be we'd change like to love, because I loved the effect produced by alcohol, and I understand when people come here and they drink again and they drink again, because I was one of those people. I love the effect produced by alcohol, and that was my solution to living, even though at that very early age I didn't know that I didn't know how to live. But I'll tell you a little bit of background about me. Even before I took my first drink, I definitely didn't function the way other kids my age functioned. I was a liar. I lied even when it was easier to tell the truth. I don't know what that's all about, but I've met several of you who did the same thing. And it was just like I just did it. I lied even when I wasn't even going to get in trouble for telling the truth, but I'd lie because it was more exciting that way. I was just actually out in Washington State visiting my brother and his wife and their kids and my sister-in-law, and I saw a snake, and I immediately had to text message my husband and tell him. I couldn't just say, hey, we were riding a bike and we saw this big, huge snake. I had to text message him and say, we are riding our bikes and I think I saw a rattlesnake. You know, it's always going to be, I've got to make it, like, more interesting than what it is. And And my sister-in-law said, well, don't you think you're exaggerating? So, of course, you know, I just said, well, maybe I am, but it sounds good. And that's what I know. Actually, the sponsor that I have today told me that I told her that I enjoy doing that sometimes. I don't know why. I want to make stuff sound better than what it is. And she said, well, why don't you try doing this for a while? Why don't you, when you do it, just raise your hand and say, excuse me, that's a lie. Here's the truth. And I thought, oh, my God. And I got a little agitated with that. I thought, that's a little bit extreme. But I'm trying to keep count of how many times I do that. So maybe several times during this evening I'll say, excuse me, that's a lie. But anyway, I was definitely a liar. I was a cheat. I was a thief. I used to steal money from definitely my mom's purse, my dad's before my parents got divorced. I didn't limit my stealing to my family. I limited it I expanded it to when I was babysitting. I would raid their medicine cabinets, look for, you know, if they had money somewhere that I didn't think they would miss, I'd take that. Just all kinds of stuff. Once I started drinking, though, my thievery took off as well as my drinking, and certainly my lying, because I had to lie. Allison, where have you been? The movies. We weren't at the movies. We were down by the canal getting drunk. You know, who are you with? Oh, just some girlfriends. We were with some girls and some guys. And generally, both the girls and the guys were people I wasn't supposed to be hanging around with. It was like just second nature to me, lying. And I don't know what that's all about, but my behavior even before I started drinking was really inappropriate. I started getting sent to psychiatrists and psychologists before I even took a drink. I think when I took a drink, I really needed a drink. And so I was acting out very inappropriately. And my parents, even after they got divorced, they used to really worry about me and wonder what was wrong with me. And they would always say stuff like, you've got a lot of potential, you're smart, why are you doing this? Why are you hanging around these people? Why aren't you interested in this anymore? Why aren't you doing that anymore? And I don't know. And our book talks about that. Once in a while, alcoholic may tell the truth, and the truth is we don't know. We don't know why we got drunk the last time. We don't know why we're doing this crazy, insane stuff. We just do it. So by drinking a lot and lying a lot, I got kicked out of New York State, and that's how I ended up in Virginia with my father. I had a big party when my mom was away for the weekend. The neighbors called my mom where she was. She came home, and the next day I was on a plane to Virginia, and there was no getting out of it. And I remember every time my mother used to threaten me with this, if you do this again, I'm going to send you to live with your dad. And my dad was very strict, and I loved my dad, but he was very strict, and I didn't think I could get away with what I was doing in New York and Virginia. And I somehow always managed to talk my way out of it. You know, oh, please, I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. And you know that. I can't tell you how many things I've sworn I'm never going to do again, and I've been doing them that night. And so this time, she just wasn't up for it anymore. My mother and I would get in physical altercations. You know, I've punched her in the face before. I've done a lot of stuff with my mother that I'm not proud of at all. We have amends to clean up that stuff, but we did not get along. And I, for a long time, and even 12 years into my drinking, I blamed my mother for being who she was. And it's not my mom's fault at all. The truth is, I wasn't a very good daughter. I didn't reach out to her. I wasn't giving. It was all about her being a bad mom, and she raised me wrong, and this and that and the other thing. She doesn't take enough interest in me. And I always love that. When people I sponsor now, or even just people I know, say, you know, so-and-so is a real snob. They don't talk to me. They don't, you know, they looked at me funny or something like that. I will generally say, well, are you talking to them? Are you reaching out to them? What are you contributing to their life? And see, that's the thing. It was a lot easier for me to blame all of you for what was wrong with me. And so for a lot of years, I did that with my mother. But anyway, she kicked me out of the house, and I moved to my dad's. And he was a naval man. He graduated from the Naval Academy. He was very structured, very strict, And I, within a week, was doing what I always do. We, you know, water seeks its own level, and alcoholics seek alcoholics. And I, within a week, I was hanging around the alcoholics and back to my old stuff. And I remember a big thing my girlfriend and I used to like to do. We'd go to the giant grocery store, get these big bottles of Budweiser, go in the bathroom, drink them, and walk right out of the store. And I am always amazed when I think about that today, because I think, I don't think I could get away with that today. I think there's too much security cameras. But we got a big thrill out of that, and it gave us this big sense of power. We're real power seekers. Our book talks about that, too. Lack of power is our dilemma. And definitely, before I started drinking, and definitely when I was drinking, I was on this big search for power. What can I do to make me feel important? What can I do to make you not necessarily respect me, but be afraid of me? You know, that gave me a big thrill if somebody was afraid of me. God, now I'd feel horrible if somebody were afraid of me, but I don't think anybody is. So, you know, I used to punch people. I used to beat them up. I used to try to get a reputation for myself. I thought that was exciting. And I wanted that sense of importance and notoriety and power. And all I was doing was really just going right downhill. And that's how I went through high school. You know, when I started drinking, I told you I was a blackout drinker, definitely. I didn't start drinking every day, because at that age, I couldn't find it every day. I did get into some outside issues, and which I was doing every day. But I couldn't drink every day. And alcoholism is progressive in nature. And I will fast forward a little bit. I did get into one college, and I went there, and I lasted there for 1 year. And by then, I had become a daily drinker and a morning drinker. And I suffered really severe withdrawal. I had seizures. I would vomit if I didn't have enough alcohol in my system. I would shake. And I said this one other time. It wasn't just my hand shaking. My whole body would shake. People began to notice my body shaking and wondering what was wrong with me. And all it was alcohol withdrawal. When I was 13 and I started drinking, that was not going on yet. But alcoholism is progressive in nature. And just because I have been sober a little while, if I were to go out tonight and go to the Sheets down the road and get a 12-pack, I am going to pick up right where I left off and even get worse. And I do know that today. I used to know that on an intellectual level, but I never believed it. I thought, well, if I drink again, it'll be different. I'll beat the odds. But I don't think I would beat the odds today. So by college, I was drinking every day, and I was suffering a lot of withdrawal. And I was away from my father for the first time, and could make my own rules. Not that I wasn't trying to make them anyway, but now I wasn't getting grounded all the time. And I didn't have to sneak out of the house in the middle of the night. If I wanted to go somewhere, I'd just walk right out my dorm room. But, you know, I didn't make it to class. I was put on the whole academic probation the first year, and then the second year I didn't go back. And it was just mortifying. You know, I did things there. I started doing things there that I told myself, if I ever did those things, I wouldn't drink anymore. And I don't know about any of you, but, you know, what I had to do was I started out in life with some sort of moral code. You know, my parents taught me right from wrong. I wanted to be a good person. I didn't like who I was becoming. And I had always, when drinking started being somewhat noticeable in high school, I told myself, well, if I ever do this, or if I ever, you know, get a DUI, or if I ever do this, I'll slow down, or I'll consider stopping. Well, all of a sudden, I'm starting to do this stuff. And what I do, because I've got to rationalize my continuing to drink, I just lower the bar until there's just no moral code left. And because at 16, I got arrested for drunk driving. I cannot believe that is the only time I've gotten arrested for drunk driving, because I drove drunk all the time. I've gotten a lot of speeding tickets. I almost got my license taken away for that. You know, when I came to you, My license was suspended. I had no insurance. My car wasn't inspected, and the county sticker I had on my car I stole from my next-door neighbor. And so I was like a DMV nightmare. And Dale and I went down to the DMV to try to get this all sorted out so I could drive legally because, by the way, having a suspended license never stopped me from driving. It was just, you know, I was a little bit more aware of where the police were. And we were in the DMV for, I know, 3 hours before that whole mess got straightened out. But that's how I lived. My life was incredibly chaotic, incredibly unmanageable. And never mind all the outside stuff that was going on, I started feeling so horrible about who and what I had become. I dropped out of college. When I left Longwood after the first year, I originally am from Northern Virginia, and I went back to Northern Virginia. I lived with my dad, and I tried to go to a college there, and that just didn't work out because I couldn't drink and go to school. And so I just let school go, and I'd always wanted to finish college. And so there's another thing. Boom, right out the window. And I know it just crushed my parents. They were mortified, I think. They had really wanted me to finish my education, and I just was throwing it right at their face. And I thought, I'll work full-time. I used to pride myself in my work ethic until I started drinking. In the beginning of my drinking, I had somewhat of an all right work ethic. I think all of us are real smart, and when we're sober, we have incredible work ethics. Even if we complain all the time about the work we're doing, we still have a really good work ethic. But you know, now I'm a morning drinker, and I'm a big call in sick all the time person, and I couldn't hold on to jobs. I'd go in. Like, if I knew I'd called in sick to one job too many times, I'd go in after having had alcohol that morning. I'd get up at, like, 5 in the morning. I'd come to. I'd have 4 or 5 beers. I'd go in. They'd smell me, and that would be the end of the job, you know. And I wouldn't shower a lot. When I first got sober, I hadn't showered, I think, in 3 weeks. And I remember the first year of my sobriety, hygiene was a big issue for me. I had to sort of retrain myself in the hygiene laws. And I didn't clean my apartments. I didn't do any of that stuff. And I always knew I was going to get evicted from them anyway, so it didn't really much matter. But so I started working, and I had a very difficult time hanging on to jobs because my drinking was already bad. And just all the lies I had to tell. I remember telling this one job that I really liked that my grandmother died. And she had died way long before, but I told them she died, and that bought me some time. And then the next time I got in a jam with them about calling in sick, I told them the same grandmother died, and somebody actually remembered, and he's like, didn't your grandmother already die like 6 months ago? And I thought, oh my gosh. And so that's how I was living my life, you know. Nothing in my apartments was ever connected all at once, like the telephone, the electricity, the rent paid on time. I told you how my driving status was. My license was suspended back then more than it wasn't for non-payment of fines. I'd get speeding tickets and wouldn't pay them. I wouldn't even pay the $20 to register my license plate or my vehicle because I needed the $20 to drink. And I get it pulled over for expired tags. It's just crazy. It gets to be this awful, vicious cycle. And so that's how I was living. And it's funny that, you know, our book talks about to accept spiritual help or to go on living the way we are, they aren't always easy choices to make. And, you know, I hated who I was becoming. At the end of my drinking, I truly wanted to die. I'm too much of a wimp to kill myself, but I really was hoping that I just wouldn't wake up the next day. I couldn't stand who and what I'd become. It was not what I wanted to be. And it was a little bit worse than what I thought I was capable of, actually. But I would come to you and still think that I had the answers to solve my spiritual problem. And I realized I didn't even know that what I had was a spiritual illness. Our book talks about selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. I always thought alcohol was my problem. If alcohol were my problem, all I would need to do is stop drinking. I wouldn't need to come to AA. I wouldn't need to take any steps. I wouldn't need to worry about the traditions, concepts, service, nothing. Sponsorship, it would all go away, and I would have been home tonight watching the NFL game, you know? I mean, but seriously, I wouldn't need to do anything that we do here. But what I've got I mean, alcohol is a symptom of my spiritual illness. That's how my spiritual illness manifests, through drinking alcohol. Life becomes so intolerable to me that the only good idea is a little bit of relief that I know I can get from alcohol. And so that's what I did. I never understood that. I came in and out of AA for 9 years before I actually grasped that. I went through treatment center after treatment center, psychiatrist, psychologist. Billy Hill talks about this, so does Lynn. All this spiritual literature we have all collected, all those self-help books from Barnes & Noble. And I couldn't even tell you what any of them said anymore. I don't think I have them anymore, but I would get really good and drunk and read these self-help books and say, okay, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I'm going to start living my life differently. And tomorrow was always another day. It was always a way for me to get a fresh start. If I had just lost a relationship, it would be like, okay, the next relationship I get, I'm not going to be this way. I'm going to be better. I'm going to get a good job and I'm going to keep that job. I'm going to be kind to my family. I'm going to show up for Christmas, because that was a big issue. I wouldn't show up for Christmas. I wouldn't even call. A big thing I did when I was drinking, I played Drunken Dial. And if anybody's ever done that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I would get really drunk, as I did every night. And the bug usually hit me between midnight and 2 a.m. And sometimes I wouldn't even know who I called till I got my phone bill that I wasn't going to pay, so the phone was going to be cut off. But I would call usually people in my family or sometimes friends at work, and oh, God, that's just the worst. But I'd call all these people and tell them how horrible they are, what they haven't done for me. I'd be crying, my life is a mess, and you're not fixing it. And that's the thing. I always wanted somebody to fix me. And not only did I want you to fix me, if you didn't, I would act like it's your fault that you can't. You know, I always put my stuff on somebody else. I've never been accountable until I came to AA and started doing some stuff. I was never accountable for my actions. But people don't like getting called between the hours of midnight and 2 in the morning. They don't like it at all. My mom stopped even answering the phone. My dad stopped answering the phone. My brother stopped answering the phone. I mean, it got to be a little, you know, they knew who it was at that time in the morning. But one time when my brother did answer the phone, I always tell this story because it was instrumental in my sobriety. I called my brother and told him I wanted to kill myself. Now, if somebody calls me with that coming out of their mouth, I don't know how I'd react. I think I might get a little upset. It was just so incredibly selfish of me. Everything had to be drama, you know. And for me to say I want to kill myself, that is code for I need attention and feel sorry for me. He didn't know that's what it was code for. He really thought that his sister might actually this time do it. And out of his mouth came the most incredible sentence I've ever heard. But he said, Allison, my boss is an alcoholic, and he goes to AA, and he's into this big book, and he's going to a big book study this weekend. Would you go if I can get him to get you in? And I just thought I would drop the phone right then and there. I thought, oh, my gosh. And it's funny how God does for me what I cannot do for myself. And that's back in the day when Joe and Charlie was big. I think it was back in 1992. And I wasn't going to sacrifice the whole weekend going to anything AA related, but I did go for a day and a night. And that's how I met who is now my husband. And I told you I've been through a lot of treatment centers. So I've been through four. And I had at least four big books from every treatment center, it was packed away. The one I pulled out was packed away in a box, and I mean, I didn't even look at the thing. The only time I ever read it was when I was drunk. I would read the stories in the back, and I liked the stories in the back. I still like the stories in the back. I just don't read them drunk anymore. And so I unpacked my big book, and off I went to Frostburg, Maryland to this thing. And it was amazing. I never, ever, ever knew of all the in and out I'd been in AA that the directions to taking these steps were in this book. And I was a little embarrassed, actually. And a seed was planted. I didn't stay sober. I told you I didn't get sober until June 5th, 1993. But I was introduced to something that I'd never, ever, if I had been introduced to it, I sure didn't pay attention to it. But it really took hold. And it was exciting and hopeful to me. The people that I met that weekend were excited about Alcoholics Anonymous. They had problems in their life, but their life wasn't doom and gloom. They enjoyed their life. They had interests. They didn't just talk all about their drinking. They didn't always talk all about AA, but they talked like real people. And I hadn't had a conversation with anybody in a long time that was anything beyond superficial. And so that was the first week, and I was introduced to a real kind of hope here. And I knew it existed. And then I launched onto my big martyr syndrome of, oh, it works for you, but it can't work for me because I'm sicker than you. And that's a bunch of baloney, too. And I love when that happens. You know, we all have consequences as the result of our drinking. I never was married and had kids when I was drinking. God knows nobody would marry me. I remember one guy I thought for sure was going to ask me to marry him, and he didn't because I drank too much, and so he moved on. But I'm quite sure that if I was married and had children, I still would have drank the way I drank. It may, you know, my consequences would have been different. But anyway, I guess my whole point is none of us, even if we have different consequences, some people have been to jail. Some people have lost their license permanently. Some people have lost it for a while. Some people have never lost it. It just doesn't matter. What makes me an alcoholic and what connects me to you is that I've got an obsession and an allergy. And I used to think that in order to be a part of you, I had to have a really, really, really low down, I've tried to kill people story. And that's just not the case. I mean, I know people who have. And the deal with that is they're no more alcoholic than I am. They've just dug the hole a little bit deeper, I suppose. I got this notion in my mind of what I thought an alcoholic was, and until I drove off a bridge or something and survived, I couldn't come sit with you because my story wasn't as dramatic as yours. And there's a little girl, call her a little girl, but she's really in her 20s. There's a little girl I sponsor in Virginia Beach who, you know, hasn't drank nearly as long as most of us sitting in this room tonight, and she is no less of an alcoholic than we are. You know, she has that obsession, she has that allergy, and so that's all I need to connect with you, is I need to have the same relationship with alcohol that you had, and it doesn't matter if my consequences or what I did when I was drinking is a little bit different. I've noticed with every alcoholic I talk to, we all have those same feelings on the inside. I have not met anybody yet who has come into AA excited about it, or like, oh God, you know, I woke up today and I was just dying to go to an AA meeting. That is not how I felt, and I felt like I was worthless. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed, incredibly guilty about the way I treated people and the stuff I'd done and the people I'd stolen from and what I had to do to get a drink, all that stuff. And so it wasn't so much maybe outward circumstances, but definitely inward was my bottom. And I drank, the last time I drank was June 4th, 1993. And, you know, I had been without a drink for maybe 9 months. I told you by now, actually, I was living with Al. And Al is just an AA enthusiast. We went to conventions all the time. I listened to speaker tapes all the time. I had more literature thrown in my face than I could shake a stick at. And the thing about that was, it's all good stuff. But if I don't apply all this knowledge that I'm getting to my life, nothing's going to happen. I had an incredible amount of knowledge about Alcoholics Anonymous the last time I got drunk, but I wasn't applying any of it to my life. In my mind, I had already decided who deserved amends and who didn't. I decided what, if I ever did an inventory, what was going to go on it and what wasn't going to go on it. You know, all kinds of stuff. I love to run my own show. I am that selfish and that self-centered. I can go all the way to the end of the line and the bottom of the barrel, and give me just a little bit of time to start feeling better about myself, and you know what? I still can run my life better than you. I mean, that's my thought process. And so, anyway, I got up this morning, and it was 9 a.m. I went to the market. I got a 12-pack of beer, and I got a pack of cigarettes. Started drinking, and of course, you know, I drunk and dial when I drink, so I called Al at work, and that's incredibly selfish and self-centered. He works with disturbed kids. He's not easily able to leave work, and he's got his drunk girlfriend calling him on the phone. And you know, I like to make everything as big and dramatic as I possibly can. And so I expected him to come home and just sort of mop up my mess. And he did come home. He came home to make sure I hadn't yet stolen the cash, which was already in my purse. And he took it out of my purse and took it back to work with him. And when he got home that night, he let me know that if I wanted to drink, that was fine, but I needed to go do it somewhere else. I was no longer welcome in the house. And if I wanted to stay sober, that was great. I could stay, and he would try to help me as much as he was able to help me. So I came into you for the last time, not on an honest desire to stop drinking. I came with an honest desire to save my relationship, and that was the only thing I was honest about. I was at this point, the book talks about like the drowning man. I couldn't imagine my life without alcohol. I was terrified of what my life might be without drinking. And I was absolutely horrified of what it was like with drinking. So you're in between a rock and a hard place. And I wanted to save my relationship with my now husband. So I had my usual thought that I always did when I came to you. I thought, I'll come here, stay for a while. I can look good on the outside. I can make you think I'm doing this, and that's fine. I'll tell Al I'm doing all this stuff, and he'll, you know, the pressure will be off, and eventually there will be an opportunity that presents itself, and I can drink again like I want to. And oddly enough, that just didn't happen. And, I mean, I was so dishonest in the beginning of my sobriety. I'll never forget this. I thought about this driving out to Madison tonight, and I don't even know if I've ever admitted this to my husband, but sure enough, somebody will now. And he worked on the weekends, and poor Al. Al was just so terrified of my getting drunk. And I understand that. When you love somebody, you just do not want them to get drunk again. And he would bring home, you know, we had a bunch of where and when's at the house, and he'd say, this is a good meeting, you can drive to Richmond, you can go to this meeting, you can go here, you can go here. And I'm just so full of crap. And I said, okay, you know, I'll go to that meeting, and God, this is so embarrassing. And so I lied to him. And I told him I was going to this big book meeting in Richmond. It met on Saturday afternoons, and I think, or actually Saturday at 11 a.m. And so I knew not to answer the phone because I knew Al would call the house and make sure I was gone. And I'm a little slick, actually. I'm too slick for my own good, so I didn't answer the phone. And God help me if he had actually left work and come home to see if the car was there, but I knew he couldn't leave work. And so he was in coverage. And so, and I, you know, allotted what I thought would be a normal amount of time to be at Richmond at a meeting and then drive time home. And so I called him, and I was like, oh, yeah, the meeting was great. I lied about what the topic was, just blah, da, blah, da, blah. And he was happy. He thought I'd gone to a meeting, and everything was great. We had a lovely Saturday night, and then Sunday hit, and we went to our home group, and two people in my home group actually had gone to that meeting. And they're telling Al all about it. And Al's like, oh, Alison was at that meeting. Did you see her? And it's not a big meeting. And they're like, no, we didn't. And he just looked at me. And you know, I told you, I'm a huge liar. But here's where it gets so awful. Even in the face of being caught, I will still stick to my story. And I said, well, I saw them. I don't know why they're telling you they didn't see me. And I said, they probably just want you mad at me. They don't want us to work out as a couple. I mean, honest to God, that's what I said. And so I was going to stick to my lie. And I don't know how, but I'm sure in the back of his mind, he was like, oh my God, what's going on here? But I stuck to that lie come heck or high water, and that's how I was. And this is sober now I'm doing this, or without a drink anyway. And that's pretty much my first several years of sobriety, running my own show, calling my own shots. I did eventually get my first real sponsor when I was a year sober, and I really, really liked her. And one thing that Nancy taught me was an incredible respect for AA. I had no respect for AA. I had no respect for anything. I didn't care that it took a lot of love and service to get a meeting going, to start a meeting, to set up for a meeting, make the coffee, greet people, all that stuff. I didn't care. I just walked into the meeting and, you know, took my place and then left afterwards. And she taught me about getting a home group and getting a job in a home group and getting to meetings early and trying to reach out to people, trying to get to know people. And that was the last thing I wanted to do, was take an interest in you. I was so afraid of people that sticking my hand out to anybody was just, it terrified me. But, and I couldn't even understand why she was saying this, but she said, you know, AA is what is saving your life. And you owe it to AA to give back a little. And AA does deserve some of your respect. And that's how pompous and snooty I was. I didn't even think the program that ended up saving my life deserved much of my time. You know, I was regarding it still as an inconvenience in my life. And so Nancy taught me an awful lot about fellowship and service. But there are three sides to our triangle: unity, recovery, and service. And so she taught me about unity and service just incredibly. It got to the point I was doing a lot. We started a lot of meetings in our community because there weren't many when we got sober. By then I was attempting to work with women. I didn't have much of a message to give them, though. I had never been through the steps as they're outlined in our book, and I was still suffering from an incredible bout by now of untreated alcoholism and just an incredible ego. On the outside, I would be nice and kind, and on the inside, I was just dying. I was absolutely dying, and I didn't know how to talk about it. And I had this thing in my mind where I've been sober X number of years. I'm not supposed to have these problems. Well, you know what? I'm 14 years sober, and I have lots of them. You know, some of them get worked out. Some of them don't. Some of them just recycle. It just doesn't matter. I don't know anybody, no matter how long they've been sober, who doesn't have life problems come from time to time. And I was so arrogant that I thought, well, at that time I was maybe 5-6 years sober, and I thought, well, I'm supposed to be an example. I'm supposed to be problem free, and I'm supposed to have it all together. I have learned far more from people who are honest about where they're at in meetings than from the people who put on a show in meetings. And that's just, I just don't like humbling myself to tell you where I'm at sometimes. And that's the truth of it. So, you know, I don't know how I was actually going without a drink. I have to believe some of it was just how incredibly busy I had become in AA. But, you know, you can't stay busy here forever. I know some people, they can live with untreated alcoholism for a long, long time before they take a drink. Some people can't. I just don't know. I don't know when my number would have been up. I have the feeling it was coming up around 9 years, because that's when everything in my life just imploded. And I felt absolutely awful. In sobriety now, I'm feeling the same way I did right before I came to you for the last time. I was feeling awful about myself. I wasn't who and what I wanted to become. These two women that I was trying to work with in AA, I had no message to give. Our book says if we want to transmit this message, we have to have a message to transmit. And it's a good idea if it's clear. And, I wasn't doing any of that. My marriage was going downhill. I was so angry all the time. Nothing was my fault. I told you a little earlier that I don't take responsibility for my problems, so I try to pawn them off on you. If I'm angry or I'm not feeling well or things aren't going the way I think they should be going in my life, I'm going to quickly find somebody to blame. And usually the way it goes is it's my husband, a family member, and if I can't unload on them, well, then there's always God, because God knows, you know, he can't fight back with me. And it's his fault. And it's not his fault. It's not my family's fault. It's not my husband's fault. It's not anybody I work with's fault. I am really the sum of the decisions I make. Our book talks about if we're honest with ourselves, we can go back in our minds and we find that at some point in time we've placed ourselves in a position to be hurt. So I've made some decision based on me that has put me exactly where I am. And I don't like it all the time, but that's the truth. So at 9 years sober, I decided that I was going to run away from home. And I was going to go to Boston. I was going to be a yoga teacher. And to heck with AA, to heck with everybody, I am getting out of here. I am a runner by nature. Every time I got in trouble when I was drunk, I would run. I'm a firm believer in geographical cures. They don't work, but I was a firm believer in them. And the thing, I don't know what happened, but I intuitively knew that if I had done that, I was bringing me with me. And I was just so tired of always acting in a bad manner or in a manner that I was going to regret. And so I was at this big book study in Richmond. It was in 2001, and a man there was going through the steps in the book, and I my husband and I had both known this man since the day we got married, actually, and I asked him for help. I asked him if he would be willing to help me. I had a very awful relationship with money. I told you I couldn't stand my husband. I didn't, if you really ask me, there weren't many people that I genuinely liked who were close in my life at that time because I was too busy blaming them for my unhappiness. And so everything was just all over the place again. And I really believe I could have gone two ways. I could have gone the way of asking for help. I could have gone to Boston and I'd be drunk right now. And I really believe that's what would have happened. And so I asked for help, and I got it. And I started going through these steps as they're outlined in the book. And then right around steps 8 or 9, Bob told me that I needed to get a woman sponsor. And I really do believe that. I really believe men work with men and women work with men, women. And I had a lot of marriage stuff going on. And I'm so grateful that I went through all that with a woman. You do what you do. That's just my own thing. And Linda came into my life, and she, it was just the most incredible experience I've ever had, really, those 5 years. She took me, even though Bob had taken me through a lot of the work in the book, she took me through it all again. And, you know, I would talk to her. This is so embarrassing. I would talk to her every night about what a jerk my husband was and how mean he is and blah, 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 blah. And I know, God bless her, she has an incredible tolerance for listening to other people. But one night I think she just had lost it. And she said, you know, are you ready to do anything about this situation? Or are you just going to keep blowing hot air around? And I'm just, like, looking at the phone like, how dare her? And she was right. And I did all this inventory on it. She had me set up to make amends to my husband. And I've said it before, I would have preferred to have been in a coma when that happened. I actually had to take responsibility for what I was doing in that relationship. The truth of the matter was, I was not a nice wife. I expected my husband to do everything. I expected him to pay our mortgage, pay all the rest of the bills, take care of the yard, cook. He's actually a good cook, but I expected him to do everything. And then on the days that I decided to have a temper tantrum, I expected him to take out the mop and mop up that mess too, because shouldn't he, you know? And so I was a very selfish wife. I was not giving in my marriage at all. And when I got all that down on pen and paper, now I understand why she asked me the question, am I going to keep blowing hot air about this, or am I going to do something about this? And then I looked at stuff like with my mom or my father, and she had me clean up where I'm wrong in all of those relationships. And I had never done that. And by now I'm 9-10 years sober. And I had done some mumbling about amends. I'd never followed through on anything. I had never really made myself a part of your life. I had definitely held you at arm's length if it was, you know, inconvenient for me to have you in my life. A lot of stuff. My relationships were unbelievably defective, although at that time I had no idea they were. And I did not know how to be a friend among friends, an AA member among AA members, a worker among workers. I was always getting ticked off at people I worked with. And it's funny, for the past 5 years, I have not had that situation. I'm not saying there's not some people I work with that I'd rather wish they worked somewhere else, but I don't have to engage myself in it all the time anymore. I'm just not that important, even though I like to think I am sometimes. But my relationships were so defective. I was suffering from all of the bedevilments. I was definitely depressed. I was into self-pity. I really couldn't be of real use to anybody because I was spending all my time thinking about how the world and its people had wronged me and how I got a bad deal. And, you know, at that time, I guess I had thought I got the wrong husband. And it was just, it's all about what I'm not getting and what you're not giving me. And that's, I could boil it down as quickly as that. And you know, when you look at that on paper, all of a sudden my attitude, I was forced to have a perception change. And she took me through the amends, and she taught me how to work with women in a way I'd never been able to do before, because I'd never done the work before. I didn't have anything to pass on to them, and all of a sudden I had stuff to pass on to them. And I can't keep anybody sober, but all I can do, it's funny, my message doesn't change. All I can do is just pass my message on. And it was up to me, when Linda came into my life, it was up to me to do what she was asking me to do. You know, you can have the best sponsor in the world. I don't know who that is, but you can have the best sponsor according to you, and you can talk to them every day. You can spend weekends with them. You can do whatever you want with them, but if you're not doing what they're asking you to do, you're not going to have what they have inside. And I finally got that. It wasn't so much about who was my sponsor as it was, am I doing what they're asking me to do? And so God help me, if I have to hold up my hand and say, okay, what I told you was a lie, then I suppose I'll do it. I mean, she's asked me to do some stuff that, well, I'll get into that. The lady I have today has asked me to do some stuff, and I think, God, am I too? But whatever, I am up for the experience. And I don't know. Linda laid such a foundation in my life. She got me excited about Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, it's funny because I used to always talk about my husband's excitement for AA or other people's excitement for AA. I never experienced that on my own. I am excited about Alcoholics Anonymous. It truly is what has saved my life. The actions here have been what have saved my life. I used to look at it as something that I just had to do. And yes, I do have to do it, but now I want to do it. There's a big, huge difference. It's like exercise, you know. Everybody recommends, if you want to live longer, exercise. Some people absolutely love it. They look forward to doing it. And then other people, it's like, oh, my God, I got to do that. Well, that's how I used to look at AA. It's like, oh, God, I got to do this. Or, oh, my life is so busy. Oh, I've got so many commitments. I've got this. So-and-so is calling me, and so-and-so is calling me. You know what? I'm lucky that I have those commitments today. I'm lucky that people call me. I'm lucky I have places to go. Because when I start thinking that I'm more important than doing this stuff, I'm in trouble again. And I know that about me. It's an honor to be able to participate with you. And, you know, a lot of stuff has happened in the past couple of years. I have 7 minutes, or actually 6 minutes and 20 seconds to talk about it or whatever. You know, one thing that I think is common among people I meet in AA is we get so indignant when something bad happens to us. It's like, oh, my God, I'm sober in AA, and why is this happening to me? And I've heard that. I can't tell you how many times I've said it. I can't tell you how many times. I don't know what I was thinking, that, okay, once I get sober, nothing is ever going to happen in my life again. I think that's what my thought was. And, you know, I see people who aren't alcoholic, and they have life come to visit them too, so why not me? I think the thing I'm grateful about today is, by doing what you have asked me to do, I am far more equipped to handle those tough times. If I am living in untreated alcoholism, God knows what's going to happen if something bombastic happens that rocks my world. But when I am living in the solution here, one problem, one solution, I know what to do. It doesn't always mean I'm happy and grateful, but it means I know what I'm going to do. And you know, I have a lot of stuff happen. Al and I have been trying to have kids, and we've lost two. And I'll tell you how the last 18 months have gone. I lost a baby when I was 4 months pregnant. 6 months later, my dad died. Another 6 months later, I got pregnant again and lost that. And then in June, Linda died. And, I mean, and it was like every time I thought I was getting beyond the latest tragedy, an even worse one seemed to strike. And I thought, when my dad died, that really crushed me, because I loved my dad so much. And I'm just grateful that he and I were clear with each other. We had a good relationship, and I was there when he passed away, and I was able to be of service at the funeral. And so that, I mean, I can't ask for much more than that, actually. When Linda died, that hit me in a very different way. Linda has always been there when all this other tragedy has gone on. And, I mean, I when my dad died, I called her at 6 in the morning. We talk, and, you know, I never called her at 6 in the morning, by the way, except during that situation. And but she always, my dependence has always been on God, but God talked to me a lot through Linda. And I've always made a point since I've been in AA to have a good relationship with my sponsor. I put a lot of effort into that relationship. I know it's not on, it's not up to my sponsor to put a lot of effort into me. They want to see what I'm going to put into the relationship. And so I had 5 years with her, and I put a lot of effort into that relationship. And so when all this stuff happened, losing kids, losing my dad, when all that happened, Linda was just there. Linda and the ladies I sponsor and the people in my home group are the people that I absolutely relied on. And all of a sudden now she was the focus of the tragedy. And I think in the beginning when I found out what's going on, she had a stroke and never came back. And she died a week later. And I just thought, I was really, quite frankly, of course, my first thought is always, what am I going to do? And I'll tell you, that was no different now. And I didn't want to get another sponsor. I was just really, I just thought, oh, God. I mean, I thought she was going to be my sponsor forever. And I just, I absolutely loved her. Probably, I don't know, as much as I could love anybody. And so I didn't want to get one, and I didn't want to get one. And I thought of this brilliant idea of that. Well, Linda always taught me that my dependence needs to be on God, so, okay, she's gone, and I guess it'll just be me and God now. That's just crazy, crazy, crazy. And even my husband got a little paranoid, because he's like, do you need me to help you find somebody? Do you want to talk to me? And I thought, oh, my God. And I did get one. And I got, actually, the first one I got didn't work out. And then for the past, I guess, month, I've been working with this new woman, Erica, that Linda used to sponsor as well. And I had this idea that if I get somebody within my own sponsorship family, it will be the same message. And actually, a lot of it is. It really is. It's just a different way of delivering it. And I remember the first time she said something to me that I didn't like, I thought, screw this. I'm not doing this anymore. I don't have the energy. I'm not up for getting to know somebody this way again and telling them all the, you know, all the people in my life, telling them all their backgrounds. And she's not even talking the way that I think she should be talking. And here I am again. You know, it's only been 2 months without a sponsor, and I'm already crazy again. And so I thought, you know what, this is exactly what I need to be hearing, even if it's what I don't like. And she was correcting me, and I just, oh, I don't like it. And it wasn't even like she was correcting me. She's like, you know, you might want to look at it this way. And I thought, how dare her tell me how to look at anything? She doesn't know me, and she does know me now. And so it's a change, and I don't like change. It's overwhelming, it's exhausting, but I also know what the alternative is, and if I'm unwilling, then I know what I've got waiting for me. I know exactly what I've got waiting for me. And the reality is Erica is a wonderful lady. She is on this spiritual path the way all of us are. She is trying to seek a relationship with a power greater than herself. She works with a lot of women, and she has a clear and effective message. I just have my knickers in a twist because I'm still mad that Linda passed away, and that's all that amounts to. And I can go ahead and be angry about it. I just have to be willing to do what somebody's asking me to do. And so if I would say anything to anybody else tonight, it's no matter what happens, just never lose your willingness to give AA a chance. And thank you so much for having me tonight. And God bless.